Hello, this is Medscape 101. I'm Eric Topol, Editor-in-Chief of Medscape, and I'm really delighted to have with me George Church, one of the most noted scientists, engineers, geneticists in the world, and certainly one of the most interesting people in all of biomedicine. So welcome, George.
Thank you very much.
And George is a professor at Harvard, and he has done an immense amount of things, and we could talk all day. But I just want to get into first maybe a bit of background, because a lot of people in the medical community may not be so familiar with how you kind of came through this thing where you were at Duke and you got combined degrees in 2 years in zoology and chemistry, I guess. And then something happened during your postdoc there.
I flunked out of my PhD and had to go to a lesser university, Harvard.
Right.
For my PhD with Wally Gilbert.
And then you were at UCSF for a stretch?
Yeah, with Gail Martin on embryonic stem cells.
Right. Who would have known that would play out like it did? And and then back at Harvard since, what?
86.
86. So quite a long stretch there. And you've been expanding your reach there. You've had, what, the Weiss Institute?
Yeah.
What does that do, the Weiss
Institute? So the Weiss Institute, biologically inspired engineering, and it's basically innovative and incubator for translation into companies.
And you want to be known more as an engineer than a scientist, is that right?
I think I'm at the overlap of everything from basic all the way out to putting things into societal settings, yeah.
And so what's interesting is you've gotten into so many things over the course of your career, everything from obviously sequencing the genome and founder of many companies related to that and assisting many companies, to synthetic biology. You wrote one of the most extraordinary books, Regenesis.
Yeah,
and that book all the way had a special feature with the, 70 billion copies?
This was an experiment I did with my own hands. Actually, I wrote the book or used a computer program to translate the book into DNA and then read it, made 70 billion copies of it, which is more than the sum of the top 100 books of all time, and then read it out with next-gen sequencing. And that's now taken on a life of its own. It's becoming a real industry.
You think this data storage in DNA will actually take off?
Yeah, so we've had funding from Technicolor, and we've been encoding some of their archival movie footage. And it's a very special application, which is archiving information. It's very challenging to do that for long periods of time with changing standards and degrading media. So DNA has an amazing record of 700,000 years without particularly good technology, and there's no disk drive that's quite in that league yet.
And that's pretty striking.
And it's a million times smaller than any other media.
So. Right. Well, maybe a future there. And even more likely since you've gotten involved.
Yeah.
Now, what about then this this whole de-extinction that you've been doing where you're trying to bring back, of course, extinct animals? You want to just give a little thumbnail about that?
I think increasingly it's being seen more as conservation, environmental, ecological conservation of current ecosystems. As it turns out, they're keystone species that sometimes are missing, and that's definitely true for the tundra, which is one of the biggest ecosystems in the world in Siberia and Canada. And at the same time, the Asian elephants are endangered, so the idea is to extend their range back out to their nearest relative, which is the mammoth, which we happen to have very high-quality DNA sequence for this extinct species. So we're basically trying to make cold-resistant Asian elephants to save that species and save the carbon that's locked in the tundra.
So you think that's going to happen?
I don't know.
It's possible.
I think we've experienced stranger things. They actually like the cold. They'll play in the snow.
Is that right?
Yeah. So just getting them from 0 to -40.
And now that's a little side project. Is that a hobby?
That is definitely a side project. It's adequately funded, but it our main work is on curing therapies for human diseases.
Right, so we're going to get into that. I'm kind of just setting up that you have a bunch of things. You do need a lot of stimulation. Right?
Yeah, right.
I can't imagine.
Since I'm narcoleptic, I need a lot of stimulation.
I can't imagine you'd ever get bored.
No, that's definitely not. Yeah.
How many people work in your lab, in the church lab?
So we have about 100 right now.
That's pretty good size,
yeah.
Okay, so now, and I'm not going to say this is the only other thing, but this is obviously an area of significant effort, which is in genome editing.
Yes.
And this CRISPR revolution is right. kind of taking us by surprise. Now, you and I are pretty close to the same age, and we lived through the Similar conference. Right. Yeah. Maybe you can just refresh what, in the 70s, what was the big controversy back then?
Big controversy back then was we might accidentally cause a problem. For example, putting a SV40 cancer gene into an E. coli vector, which is a gut bacteria, thereby accidentally causing colon cancer. None of those fears materialized, but they were combined with fears that had been around for in vitro fertilization about the same time, that even if we didn't make a mistake, we might go off and start devaluing life or something like that, so which also hasn't yet happened. But I think now that we have really powerful ways of engineering human cells, that comes up again.
Yeah, so that, of course, was really the biggest thing to happen in the whole idea of editing, designing babies' genomes back in the 70s. And then kind of fast forward to the last few years where genome editing has come center stage, and you've been a principal in that. So for those who are not fully initiated, can you just describe why this CRISPR thing, which is obviously a natural, but it's recently discovered, why is that such a big deal?
Yeah, so our group and others have pursued about 10 different ways of doing genome editing since I started my lab in 86. This is the first one that really works well in every species. We have some that work really well in E. coli, but won't work in humans. We have other ones that work in humans, but they're very hard to reprogram, to repurpose for a new gene. This one is the easiest. You know, for $60, you can get a kit from a nonprofit, and that plus a regular microbiology lab, and you're up and running. Every organism has been tried, and it works in. So I think it's mainly kind of more academic excitement. When you get to therapeutics, where you're going to be spending $500 million to $1 billion on clinical testing, I don't think it's that significant. But then the second feature comes in, which is not just the ease of use, but the efficiency of editing.
Yeah, so that pinpoint precision, that's what I want to get to. When you want to take out an A and you want to go right there, you don't want to have any off-target effects because it could have harmful consequences. So how good are we at doing this precision editing?
So straight out of the box, with a good computer program predicting where you should do the editing, you can get error rates down lower than spontaneous mutation rate, meaning that the stuff just hitting you in the air is worse. There's about six new technologies for improving the editing error rate. I mean, it's hard to say exactly why if we're already below spontaneous mutation rate, but those are another factor of 1,000. And if you do it from a clonal cell line, like a stem cell line, and you characterize the clone, that's another factor of 1,000,000. So we are many, many orders of magnitude. That doesn't mean you can't have something go wrong, but it's probably going to be a systems biology error rather than an off-target DNA error. That would be my prediction.
So you're thinking that the chance of having some untoward consequence, like cancer, downstream years later, is quite unlikely?
As long as you use the best practices, you'd really have to hit a tumor suppressor gene, which means you'd have to have off targets there. And since you can test all this stuff in advance, I think
you could be
it's
safe.
Pretty likely. Unlikely that you're going to get off target. But I still think there's kind of systems biology issues where you change one thing by any mechanism, by drugs or for gene therapy, and you get some secondary effect, which has nothing to do with DNA.
It's complicated.
It is complicated. That I think we need to remind ourselves. And that's why we do clinical trials.
And speaking of clinical trials, there are now a number in genome editing of very rare diseases, and then some that not so rare, like hemophilia, sickle cell.
Yeah, well, there are 2,000 clinical trials for gene therapies in general. There's a tiny subset that are in gene editing so far, but 2017 we'll start seeing the first CRISPR ones going, and then that will blow up to be at least as big as the rest of gene therapy. There are even more common things than hemophilia, sickle cell, which is infectious disease. So there are a couple.
HIV is a big one, right?
And cancer. So there's already in clinical trials the universal CAR T cells, so that you can have anti-cancer. So,
well, that baby was saved by T-cell manipulation editing, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That was
either
the first.
Either using Talens or CRISPR for editing.
Right, that was with Talens, but that was the first time a person's life was saved through this editing, right? Even though it was ex vivo, I guess, but very important. Now, there's been lots of controversies with CRISPR. One, of course, is instead of clinical trials, which, as you said, are really going to get going in the next year or so, there's the controversy regarding editing the embryo. And there's been...
That would presumably be clinical trial, too.
Yeah, clinical trial, but that's kind of different than people who have a condition that are, you know, well beyond having been born. You know, this is the unborn. And there's been, of course, a lot of ethical... ethicists have risen about this. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think there's a tendency to conflate... the clinical trial and the safety and efficacy testing that all new technologies have, and worries about using it in some way that's unlikely to be the first set of things to be used. So, for example, if it is restricted to reversing very serious genetic diseases like Tay-Sachs to a normal DNA variant, particular, for example, in the male sperm, you're not risking embryos. In fact, you could save embryos because the alternative is typically termination of pregnancy. So I think that scenario hasn't been discussed very much. Usually people jump to some scenario that's like 50 years away where we're creating super genius babies. And I just think that we need to get a grip on what is the likely medical pathway. And it would be very hard to refuse parents the option to avoid an abortion and have a non-Tay-Sachs family.
Whereas in the UK, they're going forward with this, at least
in the lab. Research.
But this has been banned in the U.S.? Or where does it stand in the U.S.?
No, actually, it's legal in China, U.S., U.K., and a number of places. It's just you need to have private funding in some of these places.
Oh, that's what I meant by not supported by the government, NIH, here in the U.S.
Well, it's different from a ban, but yes.
Yeah, okay.
Right.
Key point.
Yeah. For example, embryonic stem cell research was not supported by the government, but it exploded economically in California and Massachusetts and a few other places where $3 billion was committed to it. So that's very far from... No support.
That's true.
Yeah. In fact, it could have the unintended opposite consequence that if you don't support it by NIH, then it's going to be supported privately.
It might move more quickly and get even more funding, as we've seen, I guess, right? So I'm glad you clarified that. So it is controversial, though, that could this start to be used in a way which is of concern to people. Now, another controversy has been this whole patent dispute, which is, I guess, perhaps it's a distraction, but it's obviously gotten a lot of media coverage. What's your views about that?
I don't really think it's any more of a distraction than the race for sequencing the human genome. It was like, if it's what gets people's attention, then finally people are paying some attention to science. It's not the way I would have wanted it. Fortunately, I'm not involved directly in the patent dispute so far, because our patents on CRISPR are undisputed. So I think that's a good part. Yeah. So
and you've actually is a collaborator with Jennifer Doudna and the group at Berkeley.
I've worked with her. I like working with her. We never co-authored a paper together. I have co-authored a lot of papers with Feng Zhang.
Yes.
But I'm not taking sides. I like both sides.
Well, when Eric Lander published this, the Heroes of CRISPR.
Yeah.
What did you think about that in Cell a few weeks
Well,
back?
He actually. I offered to proofread it for him in advance, but he didn't give me. He only gave me a few hours before it came out, so I had to. But you know, I felt that it was a good idea, which was to give more credit, but there was some bias that other people saw, and I think in the end there wasn't that much credit given to the young people who actually did the work. That was one of my key critiques.
Was
if you're going to give credit, give the credit to Luhan Yang and Prashant Malle and Le Kong and so on.
Yeah, no,
Martin Jenick. Yeah,
great point.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll see how this plays out, but it's would you say this is the biggest thing to happen in decades in medicine, this whole genome editing?
I don't need to say that because other people have said it.
You're in agreement.
I say wait and see, really, because we have three other technologies that don't make double-strand breaks. And one of the problems with double-strand breaks is there's a side reaction called non-homologous end joining that is not actually precise editing. It's very imprecise editing. And so I think any method that is easily reprogrammed without double-strand breaks would be even better.
Well,
so I say wait and see.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but even with the technology that exists today, just last year published about how you could edit some 60 genes simultaneously and bring back the whole idea of xenotransplants. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we should celebrate where we are rather than me getting ahead of myself. But yeah, I think that even with CRISPR, it seemed daunting to change more than one gene or two genes at a time. But we took on the 62 endogenous retroviruses that had basically set back 15 years ago $1 billion investment in commitment to transplantation from pigs to humans, which is a really very promising direction. Anyway, so with CRISPR, we could do that in 14 days.
And it's incredible.
Because
of genome editing that we could actually get in to deal with the massive problem of donors' organs for transplant is really striking. Now, where do you go next? You've done so much, and obviously it's exciting. What is it that is going to be your big push over the years ahead?
I think that, well, the last thing on CRISPR that we're doing next is engineering wild species, because a huge fraction of our health problems are due to vectors, rodent and insect vectors, Lyme disease, Zika, malaria, so forth. But the next thing has to do with the brain initiative. So we have wonderful IARPA funding for connecting the brain activity map with the connectome at synapse level resolution and turning that into visual machine learning algorithms, which is like the killer application in the internet, where you can do driverless cars, Google recognition of images, and so forth. That's far behind where it should be due to lack of understanding of how the mammalian visual cortex works.
Yeah, no, I know your impact on the brain initiative is going to be very significant, and it's just actually striking how you have all these different bases covered, and you're really making momentous contributions in each. And it also is the sense that there's so much more that can be achieved, right?
Yeah.
Well, George, this has been a fantastic. If there is an interesting person in all of biomedicine, it's got to be you.
Yeah,
I wish we had hours to chat so the Medscape audience could hear about your thoughts and your the things that you think are going to be directions for the future.
Yeah.
But thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah.
And thanks
great
so
pleasure.
Much for all of you at Medscape. We'll continue to bring along some of the most interesting people in the world of medicine, and certainly that's fulfilled by George Church. Thank you.